In an ideal world, everyone would be vegan. And I think that this should be the case because we simply don't need to eat animals anymore to survive. We've evolved past that. And as evolution continues, I think we will slowly evolve away from consuming meat products and animal products because animals deserve a life too.
We should have a vegan world because the way that we are currently producing our food is not only unethical and just plain wrong, it is destroying the planet that we cohabit with all the other sentient beings. So it is our responsibility as humans to change this broken system and go vegan.
Welcome to another episode of the Live Vegan Podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Leahy, and this is a podcast featuring inspirational leaders in the animal rights community and helping vegan activists become as effective as possible. We are joined by our co-host and legionnaire of logic, Ben Lawa. Ben, I'm excited for the very last episode of 2018, and I think we are going to end on a really high note. Today, we are going to talk about dog meat and aliens. So, perhaps fittingly, we have two great guests to discuss these issues. As many of you know, I worked undercover in Korea's dog meat industry for over a year, side by side with my great friend AJ Garcia. At the start of our investigation, AJ and I were simply English teachers volunteering in our free time, but that investigation effort consumed our entire lives, and we both eventually became full-time vegan activists. AJ became like a brother to me, and after the investigation, he became president of CARE, Coexistence of Animal Rights on Earth, which is the largest animal protection group in South Korea, and also the group we trusted with the footage we had collected. AJ recently moved back to the USA to begin a new role as the director of ARM Sanctuary, and he is the host of his own podcast, The Woke Stutters Podcast, which I will link in the show notes. Our second guest is James Himes, who is an investigative journalist, film director, and founder of Watchdog Film Festival. He is the director of the documentary Korean Dog Meat Exposé, which uses many scenes that AJ and I obtained through our investigations. James is based in Australia, and both are joining us through Skype. Thank you both for being here. Welcome to the Live Vegan Podcast.
Thanks so much for having us.
All right, let's get right to the big story then. So can you, one of you, I don't know, maybe who would know the most about what's actually happened in Korea. So a slaughterhouse shuts down, but how does this happen? Do you guys know what the process was like, you know, where it started from? They feel some heat. Like, is this an activist success story?
I think that it's due in part by, you know, activists and advocates on the ground. So Koreans on the front lines. I spent the last 14 years in Korea and just recently moved back to the States. And the sole reason why that particular slaughterhouse got shut down was because the citizens that are living in that particular city filed formal complaints. They filed so many formal complaints that the Songnam City, as it's called, had no other option but to shut it down. Now, why did the citizens file formal complaints? You can credit that to the extremely hard work and dedication and perseverance of all the on the ground, on the front lines, Korean activists who are working tirelessly to end the dog meat industry in South Korea.
Wow, so you directly relate it to the activists on the ground.
100%.
Wow.
Can I,
James, go ahead.
Interject there. While that's completely accurate, there's also something obviously we know about that in the West that's studied quite often urban sprawl, what we see is that as South Korea grows up, there becomes less and less land, and land that was once a farming area often becomes an inhabited area where residents are living and schools come up and that sort of thing. So Gimpo, there's a lot of complaints in the Gimpo area recently. Now, the government had scheduled that as a agricultural area, and that includes dog meat. And there's so many complaints. We met with so many people who complained, and these guys also eat dog meat, but they're also complaining about the dog farms being so close to their properties now. Because when they moved there originally, it was more of a countryside area, and now it's an agricultural area with livestock, and dogs are livestock in South Korea. So they bark a lot. It's quite loud. It's very smelly. Like, if you've been to, I've been to many different types of farms, and I've never smelt a farm as bad as those dog farms. When you've got 2,000 dogs all in one small space, in a very small space, all urinating on the ground and defecating, it stinks. So that smell and that sound of the dogs barking travels quite far at nighttime, and a lot of neighbours complain about those sorts of dog farms. So while this particular instance in this province, the dog farms were shut down, I believe as well, because of ongoing complaints from locals, it's also to do with urban sprawl. And as South Korea starts spreading out, we're going to see more and more complaints like this as well. So these agricultural dog farms are not going to be tenable long term.
So can we use this strategy in other parts of the world? Like, I'm thinking in Toronto, there's two slaughterhouses, and they're actually across the street from each other, Riding Regency and St. Helens, and they're near a very commercial area. There's a shopping center. There's a park, like, right across the street, like where children are playing. So, you know, we go there and do outreach and demonstrations, but should we be going around to the local businesses, the people that live there, and say, hey, we need to put pressure to get these shut down?
Definitely. I've never thought of that approach.
You can. And you might have remembered the story of More on Market that, you know, got kind of shut down. And that was mainly because of urban sprawl and infrastructure work. So right across the street, you know, the Songnam city government laid down like this four lane or six lane, you know, road with bus stops and everything. So, you know, if you're not going to have, you know, a six way road and then bus stops like 50 meters, like right next to literally like a bunch of livestock slaughter. And it's different than in the States, right? In Korea, you know, these livestock slaughter places are kind of open, right? It's more of like a market, like a traditional market. So you can see the animals, you know, the live animals, you might be able to see some slaughter, you know, if you were standing at the bus stop. So,
wow.
Urban sprawling.
For those who don't know, Moran Market is a symbolic market of the dog meat industry in South Korea. And AJ and I had been there many, many times before. But it's still not shut down, right, as of now. Is that correct?
So right across the street, so right past those new roads that were built and bus stops, the Songnam City government built a huge structure, which is now going to be the new market, but it's like, it's a building. And then, so the part that we went to, Kevin, that part isn't there anymore. Like, if you went there today, you would not recognize it.
Okay. So it's all brand new.
Exactly.
Okay. So
but I must interject there.
Go ahead.
Even though Moran Market officially isn't slaughtering dogs, it's still going on. It's still going on. I mean, just around the corner now, there's several slaughterhouses. It's just done behind closed doors and pushed a little bit further away. It just means now that live dogs aren't on display out the front, which is what they were in the past. So it's been pushed behind closed doors, kind of more similar to the West. Like, if we walked along any main street in a capital city in our countries, you're not going to see cows out the front, and you don't walk up and point to a cow and they kill it, or a pig, probably a smaller pig would be more appropriate in size. But that's what was happening in South Korea. So if you can envisage it like this, you go to the butcher that's out the front on the street, you walk past, and then there's a cage with maybe a dozen to 50 pigs, and you'd point to one and then they'd pull it out the back and kill it and then come back and give you the meat. That's kind of what happens or was happening at Moran Market. It still happens at many of the other markets in South Korea. It's just that one of them, Moran Market, the most famous one, has shut down now. But as I said, it's just been pushed around the corner.
I'd prefer them all to do that.
Yeah, but
I wish they did have it in the open. Then everyone could see it and they wouldn't be hiding.
That's true. And something that a lot of people aren't actually, no one has really mentioned this in mainstream media for this particular one slaughterhouse that was shut down most recently. The owners of that slaughterhouse took all the dogs with them. So it wasn't a situation where the slaughterhouse was shut down and the dogs were rescued. No, just the actual location, physical location, was torn down, but the dogs were moved somewhere else.
So can we gather from all this, including the instance at Tapyong, that the same number of dogs are still being slaughtered in South Korea for food, that number hasn't changed?
I think the number is decreasing, but not because of this, not because of that slaughterhouse being shut down. I think, you know, there is a huge shift in the way people think about animals. Coexistence of Animal Rights on Earth Care has done, you know, two polls within a 5-year period. And I mean, in the second poll, which was after we did our investigation, Kevin, the percentage of in favor to make the dog meat industry illegal was way above 50%, was the majority.
Can I talk on that? Yes, I've got the statistics.
Oh, fantastic.
So what AJ is referring to is CARE, Coexistence of Animal Rights on Earth, the largest not-for-profit, non-government animal welfare group in South Korea. So they commissioned Han Gil Research Institute, firstly in 2011 and then again 5 years later in 2016. So what they found in 2011 was that 31% were pro-dog meat and 41% were against. Now, that was in 2011. Now, in 2016, they found that the percentage in favor of the dog meat industry had shrunk to 26%, whereas 57% disagreed with the dog meat industry. So that's a massive shift. They also found that in 2015, 73% of those surveyed had not eaten dog meat in the last year. So that's 36.5 million South Koreans had not eaten dog meat in the last year. So that's massive. That is huge.
If I heard those numbers right, that's a 16% increase over 5 years in favor of banning, I guess, or being
a trade illegal.
Right. Correct.
Yep.
So it was 41% and then 16% growth. So now it's at 57% as of 2016 who are against the dog meat industry.
Exactly. And I mean, the second statistics that I gave for 2015, 73% had not eaten dog meat in the last year. That was done by Gallup Korea in 2015. So they are, once again, an independent organization. So the Korean government actually paid for that survey to happen. So we have a few different surveys as reference points, and they all support the notion that the South Korean public are eating less dog meat.
Wow. Okay. That's tell me why I should be
jump every year.
Tell me why I should be excited about this then.
Less
dogs are dying, but are not more pigs, chickens, turkeys? Like, are they giving up meat, or are they replacing it with another animal?
That I don't know the answer to, but what I can say with specific reference to the Dog Meat Association in South Korea. So we had somebody undercover attending the Dog Meat Association meetings occasionally, and they are a member of the Dog Meat Association just for journalistic purposes, so they can get inside information. Now, what they had found and what we had recordings of in Korean were that at these meetings, the Dog Meat Association were asking people to breed 10% less dogs than the year before. That was so they could maintain the same amount of prices for the dog meat and have to do less work. So their members would produce less dog meat so that they wouldn't have an oversupply and demand would be around the same. And that's their premise. That's what they're suggesting is happening. So we are seeing from all sides an agreement that there is less dog meat being consumed. On the flip side, we don't know whether or not that is transferring to other animals being eaten. I would hazard a guess that it is, and that is a complete guess. It just means that dogs are being taken off the menu and the speciesist mentality, the carnist mentality of other animals being consumed is probably being taken up in other areas.
I'm going to have to, I don't know if I agree, because this shift in recognizing, you know, dogs and cats, companion animals, as companion animals and deciding not to eat them anymore, it's a huge shift to make in Asia. And it is, I believe, the stepping stone to improving the welfare of other farmed animals. And from working in the restaurant industry with Huggers in Seoul, I mean, the interest to try plant-based or vegan meals is on the rise. And the media covers animal abuse, they cover animal rights, they cover cruelty-free fashion, they cover veganism, plant-based eating. We have vegan festivals now every year. The president of South Korea, he adopted a rescue dog from care, and illegalizing dog meat has been brought up in the National Assembly.
Yes.
So it's a huge shift that when Kevin, when you and I were there, like these things seemed improbable of happening. So I don't think I don't think the question is, well, they're eating less dogs or are they eating other animals? I don't think it's that important yet to ask that question, because this shift is, again, like I said, the stepping stone to wider animal welfare and eventually, hopefully, animal rights reform.
There's definitely transference. I've spoken with quite a number of young people in South Korea, bilingual young people who have more global experience, and they are becoming more concerned about animal welfare as well. Like things like the pigs being buried alive when they were diseased and that sort of thing. Those sorts of imagery that floods the South Korean social network sites, that does change people's opinion and mentality about the consumption of various types of meat. The problem in South Korea isn't the youth at the moment. It's the older people who serve that food to the youth, and the youth feel obligated to eat it. It's a very different system. Like in Australia, we can't say no to our parents, but in South Korea, it's not the same, unfortunately. So while I 100% agree with AJ that there is definitely transference, that people talking about the dog meat trade and how dogs are treated, there is transference of that into other animal welfare practices and animal rights and animals being treated with respect. Unfortunately, the older population still is in control there, and that makes it difficult for the younger people as well.
Do we have statistics on overall meat consumption in South Korea? Is it on the decline? Is it on the rise? Or do we just not know?
I don't have that. No, I don't have that information, and I don't think the government is interested in collecting those details.
Okay. So let's get back to the closing of the slaughterhouse in Tapyong for a moment. I do think it is, at the very least, a symbolic victory, because it was the largest slaughterhouse in the country. I think, do you know the rate by any chance, AJ? How many dogs they slaughtered a day? Was it 300?
They were doing about 300 dogs a day. When you and I were there, you and I were actually at that slaughterhouse undercover while dogs were being slaughtered, like while that particular slaughterhouse was open. And that was back in 2012, I think early 2012. And what the slaughterhouse worker had told me is that, yeah, they were doing around 300 dogs a day.
Okay. So that was when they were at their peak. And I remember, thinking that they were sort of on the decline at that point, but let's say it was 300 when they collapsed. What activist strategies exactly can we learn in terms of getting the citizens, the civilians, to make those formal complaints? What did we find to be most effective versus not effective at all? Was it knocking on doors? Was it passing out leaflets? Was it media appearances?
I think from CARE's perspective and some of the stuff that CARE was doing, I think that just raising the level of awareness overall played a major role. And, you know, you can do that many, many different ways, and you mentioned some of them. But the media is extremely important, and making sure that the work that you are doing gets out to the media so that people watch it. Because, you know, unfortunately, you know, people, all they do is watch TV now, right? So if the media covers it, people will watch it, and they're going to get interested. But, you know, you can raise awareness in many, many, many different ways. I really think that President Moon's adoption of Tori, the rescue dog, was a big deal. And that people kind of took that as a sign of, like, you know, okay, well, the president is now adopting rescued animals. So, like,
yeah, let's talk, you know, about that a little bit more. Like, why did that happen? How did that happen? Because as far as I understood, no other sitting president had adopted a rescue dog in the whole history of the country. Is that right?
Correct. Actually, I think in the history of the world, I think that President Moon was the first one, but you might have to fact check me on that one. CARE was doing a quote unquote black dog campaign because in South Korea, there's like a stigma against, like, you know, black dogs. And they usually never get adopted, or they don't get even bought. So through this campaign, and while President Moon was about to, you know, was running for office the first time, you know, one of his campaign promises that was made to us, to CARE as the organization, was, hey, you know, I'm going to adopt a dog. And he chose to adopt from us. So it was
from us being CARE.
Yes, from CARE. Sorry,
from CARE.
Yes.
Got it. That's great. That's a milestone for sure. Okay, so how do you think the documentary that James and AJ you both directed, you co-directed together, how do you think that played a role in the shift of public attitude towards dog meat? When was it released, first of all, and how do you think the public reacted to it?
James, first, you want to talk about how you got started with the documentary.
All right. So I suppose for me, I was working as a journalist in South Korea for the Korea Observer with Tae-hoon Lee. And we were doing a lot of articles, and I took an interest in animal welfare in South Korea, especially the dog meat trade, because it was so overt and out there, and it was something so foreign to somebody like myself. And as a consequence, I came into contact with AJ. AJ had done a number of undercover gigs with yourself as well, actually, Kevin, and put a lot of that footage online. And
yeah, we now have IMDb profiles because of this movie, which was surprising. Somebody linked me through Messenger my IMDb profile, and I was like, what is this? And then I clicked on it, and I noticed that you had listed me in the credits for this documentary, Thank you.
Yeah, well, you did undercover work there as well. And if we use that, I mean, the thing is, Tehan and I were journalists doing undercover investigations. And when we say undercover investigations as a journalist, it's very different to when activists say undercover investigations. Slowly those two things are merging, but in the traditional sense, a journalist doing an undercover investigation, they're not telling the people that they're a journalist. They're deceiving the person to try and get information. And we need to be able to then justify that it's overwhelmingly in the public interest to do that, because we're actually then violating a code of ethics. And to violate the journalist's code of ethics, we then need to justify that. Whereas as an animal activist, you're under no obligation to that same code of ethics. Moving on, we were doing things from a journalistic perspective, and it seems that you guys have done a lot of groundwork. So our job is to go through and verify what you're telling us, verify the footage, and basically marry those things up to determine whether or not it's fair and accurate, whether or not it's honest and an honest portrayal of the dog meat trade. So what I ended up doing was taking a number of different resources and putting them together to try and determine what's the actual mainstream methods used to slaughter dogs in South Korea. What is the most extreme methods and how frequent is that done? And then also, how much is it all worth? So we went through and we went independently to a number of dog farms. We met with people who professed that they were dog meat trade experts. We met with inspectors and government people and professional dog farmers who had done this as their career, some of which had invested more than $1 million into their farm. So we're talking about large-scale factory farming of dogs in cages that are in some cases two stories high and higher. People have taken mortgages to raise dogs for meat. So we're talking about mainstream factory farming. So whereas AJ and Kevin Leahy, yourself, of course, went into the nitty-gritty undercover hardcore farms that do the extreme sort of behavior, Tehun and I went into the more moderate and quite often larger farms who were pushing the trade and try to legitimize it as a mainstream dog meat in association with the Dog Meat Association, who were trying to get dog meat in supermarkets, who wanted advertisements on primetime TV. And they were very open to talk to us about that because they thought that by talking to the media about this, then they would perhaps be able to push their cause in that direction, which, to be frank, was never really going to happen because the shift is away from dog meat. And I feel like they were a little bit desperate. That's basically the where we came from as journalists. And maybe, AJ, you could speak about where you came from as activists.
I talked about this a little bit on a previous episode of the Live Vegan podcast, but basically, you know, it was Kevin, you know, we were running trail one day and he asked me to volunteer for this, you know, animal rights group called CARE that he was volunteering at. And he's like, hey, you want to go talk to some dog meat farmers for a week? You speak Korean, right? It's like, yeah, okay, let's go. And, you know, that was the summer of 2011. It completely changed my life. And, you know, subsequently for, you know, the next 2 years, we did this undercover investigation. And then I met you. And I remember the day that you came, you know, close to where I was living and we met in a coffee shop and I gave you the hard drive. I remember that day. I was so paranoid because I was never that was the first time I handed that hard drive to anybody else because it had all of our footage. And and it was one of the best decisions that I ever made because, you know, you produced a fantastic, phenomenal documentary.
Yeah, I agree with that. There was a lot of blood, sweat, and tears put behind the making of that footage and creating that footage. And AJ and I risked our personal safety many, many times. So I'm glad you guarded the hard drive with very careful precision, AJ, and gave it to the right person.
Where can we watch this?
I haven't put the short version online yet. I have put the long version online. So when I say the long version, we have two very different documentaries for very different purposes. So the Dog Meat Professional South Korea is about 55 minutes, the version that we put online. We do have a 90-minute version and a two-hour version, but those versions will probably not go up for a number of reasons, including threats to be sued and that sort of thing. But the 55-minute version is online and available for free on YouTube. All you need to do is search the Dog Meat Professional South Korea, and it should come up first on YouTube.
We'll link it in the show notes.
Yeah, that's a 55-minute version. We got a 3-minute short overview or a trailer. If you can't stomach a full version that has just a few details that can introduce you to it. I mean, that went viral and it's been seen, I don't know, many times. As for the short version was mostly the undercover footage, and that version is designed just to shock people. So for people who say it's not real, it's, you know, not factual, this doesn't happen, then we have a 6-minute version and a 10-minute version and a 15-minute version for that. Now, I sent that version around to maybe 100 different film festivals. It's won more than a dozen awards. It's won film festivals and not been screened there, which I found bizarre. It's been pulled from film festivals because it's so violent. We've had people not watch it. The judges just flat out refuse to watch it, which I find apparent. You know, like we are that disassociated from where, or detached from where our meat is coming from, that we can't see animals being killed for that meat, then that to me is quite bizarre. Even at the Busan International Film Festival, people there, some of them, the feedback I got, which is unconfirmed, is that some of them just flat out refuse to watch it, which I find really disturbing in itself. If you can't watch it yourself, then why do you allow it to continue? Why are you not opposing it?
Okay, I got a question for maybe all three of you, because all three of you have been a part of activism against the dog meat industry. All three of you, I'm pretty confident, grew up in cultures that didn't have dog meat. So how do you respond to the charges of, you know, Westerners speaking out against dog meat being a problem with, you know, an ethnocentricity, hypocrites that we're speaking out against dog meat, but, you know, people in our culture eat pigs, and what's the difference?
Yeah, cultural imperialism.
Yeah.
Who wants to take
so
that
how
one?
How do you respond? Because I'm sure you get it all the time, even when I see it.
AJ, you go first, please.
Oh, God. I mean, it's one of the most hypocritical things that someone can say. Nonprofits get it all the time. In a different form of question, it's like, you know, when for example, when CARE focuses on dog meat, well, what about the other animals, right? So you kind of get both sides of the coins with that kind of question. And my
concern is being someone that's not from that culture.
Yeah, right.
Right.
I mean, it's just, again, it's hypocritical. It doesn't really make sense. Again, people are so disconnected and detached from their food source that, in a way, it's like, you know, the only ones who are not being hypocritical are the ones that eat all kinds of animals. Do you know what I mean? But here in the West, you know, it's just like, you know, we love dogs and cats, but then, you know, we eat every other animal, you know, that there is. And then we torture them in similar and if not worse ways. So I think it's just hypocritical. Forget the whole culture thing. I think it's just very hypocritical.
I'll jump on that real quick. I've said this before, that the logic is exactly the same and the arguments are exactly the same, where Koreans will say there is no difference between all of the animals. There's no difference between a pig and a dog. Therefore, we will eat all of them. And the vegans use the same logic and the same argument almost word for word, but their conclusion is exactly the opposite. They say there is no difference between a pig and a dog, therefore we shouldn't eat any of them. And it's funny how you can use sort of the same logic and the same arguments and have two completely different conclusions. So I was called cultural imperialist many, many times while doing protests in the street. I mean, clearly, if you look at me, I'm not Korean. I'm a Westerner all the way through and through. And for me to hold up a sign that said, ban the dog meat industry, was cultural imperialism at its finest. So it was a pretty heavy charge, and I was aware of it. But here's my justification for it. I saw the weakness. I saw the defensiveness in the culture where it was winnable. I could see that people felt uncomfortable about this particular industry, about this one thing. Whereas if I was to say the same thing about pigs or even about veganism, there would have been no practical, winnable solution. So I took it just from a practical perspective that I think, you know, within 5 to 10 years at that point, that we could actually get something done here, that we could actually pass a law banning the dog meat industry. And I didn't see any other winnable fights at that time, but I did see that as winnable. And so that's why I decided in 2010 or 2011 to take on the fight. And I didn't care what people thought. You know, I knew I was vegan, and I knew I was being not hypocritical. I was being morally consistent, but it sure didn't look that way when people saw me on the street holding up a sign. People didn't know that I was vegan unless they talked to me about it. And that's fine. Let them think whatever they want to think. My whole perspective is get it done. Let's pass this law, and then let's move on to the next winnable fight. So, James, you want to throw in your perspective?
Just very briefly, I found for me, I mean, I got pushed out, I got threatened, you know, as you guys did as well. I went, one of my colleagues went undercover into a dog meat auction where live dogs were auctioned off. And I walked in maybe 2 minutes after he had positioned himself strategically. And, you know, I got pushed out. I got called all sorts of names in Korean. We got forced off properties at Moran Market. I had people pushing me out, et cetera, et cetera. That's kind of normal. And if you can't put up with that, then you're the wrong sort of person to be doing this sort of work. Like all activism, there's many chains to activism in South Korea especially. Some people are pen pushers and they sit behind a desk and they call people and sign surveys and that sort of thing. Other people are more appropriate for the front line. And I think being a white guy for me, it sometimes helped us get into to situations and farms that we wouldn't normally get into if there are a bunch of Koreans there. Now, that worked because I think the Dog Meat Association, the dog farmers, in some occasions were feeling the pinch, that they were feeling that their profits were starting to be reduced, and they felt like there was a white guy willing to listen to them, and consequently, they were willing to talk to us in some occasions. But at first, there was so much animosity, and the argument would be repeatedly, but you guys eat cows and pigs, and you do foie gras, which is worse. And the answer to that is yes. Yes, as a culture, we do. But there are individuals that are advocating against all animal slaughter and advocating for animal rights. And wouldn't it be an ideal society where we didn't have to kill anything that was sentient to live? And we're at that stage now where we don't need to. And that's the sort of argument that I'd give back. But at the same time, people were only – they weren't expecting a response. They were just seeking to reinforce their own opinion. But anyhow, very quickly, one thing that has worked in favor in South Korea, Park Geun-hye, the former deposed president of South Korea, she put funds towards increasing the amount of pets that South Korean households had, which at the time I was quite concerned about, and I wrote an article on, because the more pets in South Korea, the more likelihood that some of these pets are going to be abused, end up on the streets, especially dogs and cats, and then they might end up in the meat trade as well. So I was quite concerned about that at the time. But what's happened now is one in five households have a pet of some description. That in itself is probably positive in that families then start to associate with animals some sort of sentience and emotions. And then the transference of that sentience or that concept that animals are sentient to pigs and other animals as well, that's going to happen. And that is happening, I think. So I think it's progress nevertheless.
Now, how did they inject money into the pet industry? You said the president put tax dollars into the
industry. Exactly right. So she saw that there was potential for the domestic industry to make money. Now, one of the things, and this is something, it's speculation, has not been verified at all, but at the time there was a huge push for teacup puppies or these small, tiny, miniature dogs that would fit into small bowls or cups, large cups. And they were being sold for, you know, around $5,000 a dog, sometimes more, sometimes $10,000 or $15,000 a dog. And we had people like Paris Hilton getting these dogs and Sylvester Stallone and those sorts of, you know, big name A-list celebrities. And I guess the president saw that there was potential for South Korea to make money here, I guess. And one of those things that they were going to do is put money into these facilities so that these people could pay more tax and therefore return the dollars to the government and also grow the industry. So with the average South Korean having pets, it means that they need to feed them. So there becomes a domestic pet food industry. And then the vet industry increases and more money goes into the pet industry. So consequently, people pay more tax and then therefore the industry grows, but it has the potential to export internationally as well. So that's kind of the concept behind it. And that's a guess. It hasn't been verified.
Yeah, interesting. Ben, did we answer your question satisfactorily?
Yeah. No, we touched on it. I mean, we could spend the entire episode just discussing that. So I don't think we need, but actually that just what James just said was interesting to me. So in Korea, the association with pets, like it isn't like it is in the West.
No,
not many households have a pet of some sort.
Oh, well, they do now, one in five households. But what was previously, people would see pets as luxury items. There's a Korean terminology or a word that just means luxury item. And the expensive pets were referred to as a luxury item. And there was one stage there in certain areas of Seoul, the richer areas, where it was trendy to have a dog in a handbag, just like Paris Hilton does, a little dog in a handbag and you're walking around. The problem is that they became an accessory. They were cute. And unfortunately, they weren't a long-term investment. People didn't look at them and think, I have to take care of this dog for 15 years and I'm going to give it the appropriate care. No, it was a trend. It became cute. It became cool. And that was that. So the sentience was the secondary thought. Did you want to touch on that, AJ? Because you guys took dogs from people who did horrific things to them.
Yeah, I mean, and it's still kind of going on, even though, you know, one out of every five households have pets. But, you know, because of that push, and actually when the government put out this, you know, when they injected all this money into the pet industry, it was put in a way to us, at least, because all the animal rights organizations and animal protection organizations were welcome to those assembly meetings. It was more of like an animal protection, animal welfare reform bill that would, you know, encourage a pet industry, but do it in the right way with, you know, checks and balances and all these process and, like, you know, dog parks here, dog parks there, making sure that pet owners, you know, have a license, making sure that puppy mills have a license, you know, this and that. So that's the way that it was framed. But as we know, that's never really the case. So, I mean, I think that now compared to 5 years ago, I think we're seeing less
animal abuse cases for dogs and cats. But nonetheless, it still happens.
Would you say there's a correlation between having a pet and being more receptive to the idea of veganism?
I don't know if it can stretch to that far, to veganism, but it can go to, I think, compassion, but not to the level of veganism, but just a general compassion. And maybe, you know, you think twice before, you know, before inflicting harm on anyone else, really. But I don't think that having a dog in Korea yet reaches to that level of veganism compassion. But it's a good step forward.
It's progress. Hey, so I want to get a chance to ask James about his new project. So you got a cool new film coming out, huh, James?
Cool, maybe. I hope it's cool.
Well, it sounds cool to me. Tell us about it. Share it with us. What's going
on? All right. So at the moment, it's called The Rise of the Animals. It has been called a number of things, and it's probably going to change again. But the background, well, aliens encountered Trump's Space Force, and they decided to re-inhabit Earth. At first, they slaughtered humanity. You know, they called us primates, and then they enslaved us. The strongest were forced to work, but, you know, obviously they perished quite quickly. The rest of us were hunted and captured, kind of like some of us hunt deer or whatnot, and then put into farms to be used as a food source. So that's where the script commences. So that's just the background information. So in summary, these bunch of aliens that I've called Jartsopians have expleted and used all their resources on their planet, Jartsopia, and they start a civil war over resources, and consequently one faction of society starts to look intergalactically, where they can move to, which next planet can they take over, and Earth is one of those. So they are a similar sort of makeup to us, but they are more technologically advanced. They come in, they farm us for our meat, they milk the ladies for their milk, of course, and they're stockpiling human flesh and milk so that when the third wave of Jartsopians arrive on Earth, they can have enough food to eat. So that's basically the premise behind it. I don't want to go into the ending yet because obviously that would destroy it.
Yeah, no spoilers.
Yeah, but there is two versions of this. One is the short film, which is the proof of concept, which we're actually fundraising for at the moment. We have all volunteers on this project, and we only need 7,000 Australian dollars, so about 5,000 US dollars to make this film work. So it's going to have high production value. I've spent about $2,500 so far on various props and equipment that we need. We already have all the equipment, like the high-grade cameras and that sort of thing, but there are a few little things that are just pertinent and required to sell the imagery that we're after. We've got full prosthetics for the Jartsopians. I've went and purchased a heap of different gel blaster guns, which are pretend guns that fire water crystals and that sort of thing. And I have been spray painting them and changing them. So it's going to look pretty cool, I hope. We've got about 100 actors involved so far, of which there's probably only 15 leads and supports and a heap of extras. We've got a farm that's organized, or it's not a real farm, but we're going to turn it into like a farm, do set design and construct a set there. So, yeah, it's all basically underway, filmed in Gold Coast, Australia. So that this will be the proof of concept. So once we've done the proof of concept, we're going to send the short film out to a bunch of film festivals and hopefully get a bigger investor. So the feature film, which hopefully will go to cinemas and that sort of thing, we're looking to produce for around 300,000 US dollars, which is quite a small budget for this type of film, especially considering that most of these films started around $15 million. So we are really going to be doing it on a budget, but we're only asking for $7,000 Australian, so about 5,000 US to do the proof of concept. And as I said, all that money will be spent in props or more props, building, set design, VFX, post-production work, all that sort of stuff. So yeah, this is basically the concept. So the film indirectly addresses speciesism, environmental destruction, humanity and community and compassion.
So it's cool. It's coming out not as, I mean, people aren't going to necessarily see it as an animal rights film, but the theme behind it, obviously, you know, you're hoping then they see it, they're going to make the connection.
Well, there will definitely be a lot of subliminal messages there that strongly shock an audience. Like the short film will shock an audience and they walk out thinking, what the hell? This is crazy. And that in itself is going to make people think, at least on an emotional level, think whether or not it's right that we kill animals and use them for their own products. As for the feature film, it has to be a little bit more covert because it needs to entertain firstly. And that's the problem that every activist doing fiction films faces. We do need to find that right balance between being an activist and pushing a social message and entertaining an audience. Now, if you don't find that balance correctly, then you're not going to have an audience and therefore you're not going to find investors. So we need to find that balance. And I think our script is nearly there, like our feature film script. It's about 105 pages. It is nearly there. It's nearly got that balance right. So, yes, people will watch the short and go out and thinking, wow, what are we doing? But the feature, they might have to have a deeper discussion to make that association.
I love alien movies. This is going to be great. I can't wait to watch. What do the aliens look like? Can you tell us? Or is that a spoiler?
I do have sketches. No. I've got sketches that we've got two makeup artists that are involved and a number of assistants for them as well. The aliens are kind of a cross between some of the guys that are more humanoid and you see them in Star Trek. Not as humanoid as the Vulcans? The Spock?
The Klingons?
More alien than Spock. So we do have a full head prosthetic that go over the actors' heads, covers their noses, and we have different shapes in the heads. So there are symbols and shapes on the head, and that goes around to the face and across the nose as well. So we'll see a human mouth with certain teeth put in. At the moment, we're experimenting. I've got some glow-in-the-dark sharp teeth with canines, but
Could you just, for the sake of argument, give them the exact same teeth as human teeth so that they can point at some point in the film and say, look at my teeth. I was meant to eat humans.
Every vegan watching would just be laughing hysterically and all the non-vegans would not get it at all.
Well, we could perhaps write some of that stuff in there, but we don't want to make it comical.
Right. But you got to have a couple of excuses. Maybe like the deeper psychological level, it might not be as blatant, a little covert, but some of the excuses might land in the audience's lap, so to speak, right?
Yeah, exactly. For the feature, we could do something like that. So I just need to first and foremost mention the way this sort of thing works with funding. So what will happen with this feature script, when we do get the larger bodies giving us funding, like Screen Queensland and Australia, and Screen Australia, they might, I'm just going to throw a figure out there, they might give us $50,000 each, who knows? They might give us nothing as well. But if they do give us that money, we still have that autonomy over our script. They will make some suggestions. However, if there's a large investor from another production company that comes in or from a studio, then we do lose some creative control, and consequently they will start making changes to the script. They will swap out some of our actors, unfortunately, which is something that I would be against. They will also perhaps even swap me out as a director. You start to lose that creative control. And consequently, if we do write in those sorts of secondary subliminal messages that and jokes that vegans would get, but the rest of society might just go over their head, then it would probably be written out anyhow. But I am more than willing to take suggestions. If anyone, vegan or not, wants to message me personally and send some jokes or suggestions, it would be great. Like, my wife has tried to put some humor in there a few times. For example, in one scene, one of the aliens is stacking human body parts to be put in the freezer, and all the arms are going to be left arms, for example. And when the other alien looks at it, he goes, what are you doing? And he turns around and goes, I like my meat to look neat. And she finds that hilarious and funny. Some people may not, but if you've ever been to a butcher and they take pride in their work, they do stack meat in a certain way. And one thing that is said on some of the sites that I follow, because I like to follow the meat industry directly on the ground so that I can understand their mentality as well. So I am part of certain meat groups, especially slaughter groups as well. So in the background, watching what they do. And some of these guys do slaughter and pack exactly like this because they do take pride in the way they display their dead animals for consumption. And, yeah, the aliens would be no different. And some slaughterhouse workers would be like, that's me, buddy. I love doing that. Whereas some of the vegans will look at the arms stacked and they'll be like, ah, oh, geez, that's kind of horrible.
Sure. Yeah. A little too much, too yeah. too real. So you said it's going to be filmed in Australia on the Gold Coast. Is that right?
Yes.
We do have
south of the Gold Coast.
Okay, we do have some listeners in Australia. If they want to be an extra in your film, can they reach out to you?
I want to be an extra.
Oh, I know. I want to be.
I already.
Can we shoot some scenes from here? I'll just be like walking down the street. I don't have to say anything.
And he said he's gonna you're gonna find funding for me to fly out, right?
I wish I could, mate. That'd be awesome if we could.
AJ's gonna be in the film.
Well, if
too.
if anyone wants to be involved in any way, I'd love to have them. There are only so many people we can have in the film, but as extras, you know, if there are people who want to be extras that are on the Gold Coast, more than happy to have them on board. It is in Talabudra, for those who know where that area is. It's about 25 minutes south-southwest of the Gold Coast area, the mainstream Gold Coast area. So, it's a good location, you know. It's a great place to start filming. But anyone who wants to be involved. Now, if people are willing to put money into this, great. If people are willing to put products into this that could be featured, like vegan products, for example, especially food, I would love to have a vegan restaurant sponsor. So if they could provide all the meals on set, because it is so expensive to provide food for people. And we are in a kind of remote-ish area. I mean, it is a good 50-odd minute drive, 25 minutes in, 25 minutes back to get any food from anywhere. So it does become quite a difficult task if we've got so many people on set to feed, and it's very expensive. So if we could have even people who don't have a restaurant that says, you know what, I can make food for people for one day, that would be great. That all helps, and that will all be listed in the credits so that people do get the credit they deserve for helping out, I guess.
I was thinking of a restaurant experience where a guy is sitting back eating a cheeseburger and they have a discussion and he says something like, well, I can eat this burger because I'm on top of the food chain, right before he gets taken by an alien. You know, and like dragged away. I don't know.
You want to just send me your entire script, Kevin?
Yeah.
Well, you know what? If you three guys are keen at some point, I would love to do a comedy on this. Now, some people thought I was going to be doing a comedy. And that's the self-tape that they sent in when they were applying as an actor. And I had to send back and say, you know, guys, this isn't a comedy. But I do have the perfect dude who his name's Andrew Ravuna, and he's Fijian Indian living in Australia on the Gold Coast. He's about 6'2", and his afro is probably another 30 or 40 centimeters big. And he's awesome, but he's great for comedy. And he could be one of the leads. He would love to run in and tackle a guy off his chair eating a cheeseburger and drag him out.
Yeah,
I could just see that happening. That'd be brilliant. But if you guys want to send me any ideas around some sort of comedy that you think might work and have an impact, I'm more than willing to come up and look at the script and perhaps even get something happening for that. Because there are plenty of people with the skills overseas as well that could be shooting similar sort of stuff. And the more we do it, the more mainstream it becomes, the more people get involved, and the more likely people are going to start to think and rethink their mentalities. So I just want to say one thing as well. When I was originally casting for this film, I wanted only vegans, vegetarians, or people questioning, or pescatarians, or people questioning our food production systems. And that was kind of the premise behind it, that people would volunteer and that they would be part of the community. But what ended up happening is a lot of people were attracted to this, and some of these guys are hunters and that sort of thing as well. And I think it's great for them to be involved in this sort of film, because it will get them thinking and put their head inside that of the animal. For example, when they're sitting in that cage with a number of other people or in that pen, and the aliens come in and start dragging them out and stabbing them in the neck to kill them the same way we do to, you know, cows and pigs, then it becomes real for them. And then they're going to start to feel what it is like to be that animal in that pen. And I think based on that, they might start to have a cognitive shift. They might start to question their own perceptions and judgments and values. And that can't be a bad thing. That's got to change some opinions and mindsets.
Yeah, that's awesome.
That's so true. There's actually an article that was written about The Walking Dead, the TV show, and how some of the cast, because you know they were dealing with so many dead bodies, that a lot of them stopped eating meat for a while because they were just so grossed out by like all the zombie guts and like it just you know. So they kind of made, you know, a small connection there. So I could see that happening.
Yeah,
cool. That's good feedback. Really good feedback. I didn't know about that, and I'm going to use that, and I'm going to repeat that to the cast.
Yeah, well, maybe you can do like a little bit of comedy and then the drama at the same time, like take one, take two, and then put them together at the end so you have two different movies.
I think we start writing a script, Kevin.
Yeah, okay. All right, Ben, we're on it.
No, send me ideas. After this one in February, I'm happy to write a comedy as well. I mean, and have international involvement. That would be super.
Well since see, you're thing is, open and receptive to it, we'll ask the listeners. Anyone, is that okay with you? Can we send ideas directly to your email inbox?
Yeah, that would be sweet. Even on Facebook, I'm more than receptive to receiving any of that.
Okay, all your links will be in the show notes. If you have an idea for the movie, whether it be comedic or dramatic, send it straight to James because this is still in the idea phase and he might use your idea in the movie.
Well, it's actually not in the idea phase, but we can squeeze stuff in.
For a different project, right? Isn't that what you were saying? Like,
yeah.
The next one, maybe you'll do a comedy next. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I'm more than happy to shoot a short comedy. See, the thing is, and this is the crazy thing, more people will be attracted to a sarcastic comedy on this issue than people who are going to be attracted to a drama. You know, if we had the budget of, say, District 9, sure, we'd be able to attract as many of the audience as maybe they have. It was great, yeah. Mirrored the apartheid. So what we've done, and District 9 is a good example, because we've gone back and watched the original District 9 proof of concept, and that was about 5 minutes long. It did have quite a big budget, but at the same time, it was a proof of concept, and it was done very differently to the final film. So we've written our short film based on the same style of the proof of concept that District 9 had. And as you know, it was successful, the proof of concept, and it got fully funded to make a feature, funded in the hundreds of millions of dollars level. But we're not going to ask for that or want that. But at the same
You wouldn't say no.
Well, of course we wouldn't say no. Of course not. But I very much doubt anyone's going to drop $100 million on this movie. If they did, they'd probably swap it out and buy the script off us, which would be unethical in my opinion, unless they continued to push the same sort of message that we have already and everyone was reimbursed for their time that have volunteered so far. But anyhow, a comedy on this topic would attract more viewers because the mainstream population would watch a comedy, whereas not everyone's going to be willing to watch a sci-fi. And that's just the nature of the beast, unfortunately. People like being laughed and they like being entertained and they like laughing. So I could see a cheeseburger eating guy being dragged out by a 6'5", a black alien Fijian dude. that would be comical and funny. There are also a number of other little jokes that my wife thought we should include and they're great. I'm not going to put them on here because who knows, we might make this comedy.
Yeah, that's great. All right. I'm glad you got a little gold mine going for comedic relief because, I like you said, if you can get people watching it and provide some laughs, it'll go viral for sure. I think people like that. Yeah. So
Great. Best of luck with that endeavor. We want to support you as much as we can. There is it Kickstarter or Indiegogo that you have going right now? Indiegogo, right?
We're on Indiegogo.
Okay, so I'll link that. I'll link that, and
yeah, that'd be great.
Any listener who wants to support this project, James's newest project, you can do so by just clicking on the link and supporting through Indiegogo. It's really exciting. So thank you guys. I'm sorry we're out of time, but thank you both for the hard work you are doing on behalf of animals, and thank you for informing us on the current status of the dog meat industry in South Korea. AJ, I know you're a director of a sanctuary in Florida now, so your life sounds way better than when we were working undercover. One day I have to come down and visit you and lay in the sun for a bit and talk about some old times. And James, I can't wait to see your new science fiction film that we've been talking about. It sounds really exciting.
Yeah, and I just want to thank you guys as well. I mean, we need people like yourself doing second-order activism where you're spreading messages and the word and reinforcing values and beliefs in people that already have them, but also bringing new people to the table as well. And I think that's an underappreciated area. So you guys need to pat yourselves on the back as well.
Ben, you pat my back? I'll pat yours. How's that?
Okay, deal.
Thanks, James.
You guys are doing an awesome job with the podcast, as always. And, you know, keep doing what you're doing. Thank you for having us on.
Yeah, I appreciate it. And we'll check out, I'll link your podcast as well, the Woke Stutters podcast. If you guys don't listen to it, you should check it out. AJ is the host of that podcast. And he has some.
Especially the episode with some Ben guy.
That's right. Ben Ben was on not too long ago, a couple months ago. And yeah, he's got some amazing guests on his podcast as well. So please go check that out. And thank you guys for joining us.
Thanks, gentlemen. Thank you. All right, bye.
All right, Ben. We are complete for 2018. We have just finished our last episode. And
that's it.
We will not have another episode until next year, and this is going to be released on Christmas or maybe the next day, maybe Boxing Day, but around Christmas. So for all those who celebrate, Merry Christmas. Hope you enjoyed this episode. What did you think about the year? Did we have a good year?
Yeah, man, we did. We got to talk to some amazing guests, some heavyweights in the animal rights community. You know, like Ingrid and Ronnie Lee and Gary Francione. I mean, I can't name some, you know, the big names, and then, some more local activists that have done some incredible things, and, a punk rock drummer. We got to speak at Rochester Veg Fest. We got to MC Veg Fest London. So it's,
we went
it's
to Pybird up in North Bay.
Oh yeah. Pybird. That was magical. That was my favorite. Okay. You know, I don't pick favorites. That was my favorite thing we did. Just sitting on the porch outside recording that episode in person, and just all the residents and, you know, well, family members that they were to the Pybirds. That was pretty magical. That was really cool.
Yeah, just the sounds of nature around us and being there in person was really, really spectacular. It's something I'll never forget.
We don't get to record episodes with a goat walking past us very often.
That's right. Thankfully, she didn't come in and chew up the wires or anything.
Yeah, and so what do you think? What do you think 2019 is going to bring us?
Man, we did have a really good year. You're in charge of booking guests, so I have to give you so much credit. There are a few exceptions where I used some of my contacts, but for the most part, Ben books the guests, and he has done an incredible job getting people who have done truly remarkable things to come on the show and talk about what they've done and how they've been successful and how they've been effective, what things worked, what things did not work. And collectively, the episodes really serve as a toolkit, like a way to learn. If you want to be an effective animal rights activist, then listen to all the things that people have done in the past and then learn from them so that you don't make those mistakes and we can all move forward together faster, quicker, more efficiently and save more animals. So I'm just like, I'm so inspired and I'm really happy that this podcast has turned into what it has turned into. And I'm looking forward to 2019. I know we have, can I say a name or should I keep it?
Sure. You can drop a name if you want. Right.
So Bruce Friedrich's going to be, I think, our first guest of 2019 and he's the executive director of the Good Food Institute. It's an incredible organization doing amazing work to save animals, to really, truly bring about a vegan world. So that's how we're starting off the year. I can only imagine who we're going to end up interviewing and having on the show throughout all of next year. And we do intend to go all of 2019, right, Ben?
Unless and beyond. And anybody that's got ideas, whether maybe you have a connection to somebody that you think would be a really cool guest, or you're just like, hey, I'd love to hear an interview with so-and-so, just shoot us a line, let us know and say, hey, have you ever thought about reaching out to this person? And I do want to say too, is that we have a very wide array of guests. I mean, we've had people come on talk about intersectionality. We had a vegan beer maker. We had people doing all kinds of, different street activism and more, large organizations, animal testing, dog meat, everything. And the reason that we do that is because there's a lot out there that you can do. And we want people, and Kevin and I both at one point were more, quiet vegans that weren't really doing much, is we just want people to see there's so many different things you can do. You don't have to do everything, but do something. And maybe there was one guest that was on that spoke to you and said, you know what? I can do that. I can make a difference doing that and get involved and just kick some ass.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't even have to kick ass. Yeah. You can just like take a step forward as if you're getting ready to kick an ass.
Okay. Okay. But, as long as the end goal is kicking ass.
Right. Take that first step though towards the ass.
Okay.
Do whatever.
Can I quote you on that? Can we put, how we do sometimes do those memes from our guests or like quotes they said?
Sure.
We put Kevin Leahy, take that first step towards the ass.
With a thumbs up, a big smile.
That was a direct quote. That's what
always taken out of context. These.
That's it. That's how we're gonna end the year. I can't top that.
Well, like I said, I'm excited. I hope that some people do give us some ideas for next year. We do have a couple of exciting ideas that are coming into fruition as of all of January already. So stay tuned. Thank you guys for subscribing. Please leave us a review on iTunes if you can. That helps spread the message. It helps with search results. If people are looking for a good vegan podcast, it'll pop up closer to the top if there are more reviews. Also like us on our Facebook group, The Live Vegan Podcast, and support us on Patreon, patreon.com/ The Live Vegan Podcast, where you can support us for as little as $1 per month. Ben and I do not take a salary. That money goes toward helping get more people to listen to the podcast and spreading the message of each individual guest. We want to amplify each guest's message. So just getting more people, whether they be vegan or non-vegan, to listen to the message we're trying to spread. So that's where the money goes. And like I said, we don't take a salary. It's just for that. So thank you guys for listening. Thank you for the support. Thank you for an incredible year. Thank you for all the comments you guys have made. And we look forward to next year, 2019. Ben, any last thoughts?
See you in the new year.
That's right. As always,
live vegan.
Thank you for listening to the Live Vegan Podcast.